To my dearest friends, I am honored to welcome you back once more for another investigation into one of the many shrouded entities which threatens to topple the once great imperium of man. If we were to look upon any settled world within the vastness of our galaxy, from the surface, it would initially appear to be somewhat functional and perhaps even peaceful. The citizens will toil away day after day in the service to the planetary nobles, and their various industrial outputs would ever be exported to fuel the great war machine of the Imperium, to preserve mankind's precarious place as the undisputed lords of the void. But to peel away the layers and to look below the city streets into the darkest, long-forgotten corners of a world, it has become an increasingly common occurrence to find a secret society ruled not by the hands of a human, but by the foulest claws of an alien. I would, of course, be referring to the malignity of the gene-stealer cults, which have come to infest many a world, twisting its loyalty from the Emperor towards a deceptive patriarch who will ultimately wish to lead this planet to its inevitable fate of being consumed within the bowels of a tyrannid bioship. The cultists, who now follow their four-armed bestial lord, have unknowingly fallen to the psychic song of the gene stealer, prompting them to corrupt the wider society of their world, bringing more and more innocent souls into the fold of the growing cult. The faithful will worm their way into every single major industry, redirecting any valuable resources into hidden manufacturers to erect new weapons of war for the growing armies. When the fabled day of ascension finally arrives, then the warriors of the cult will stage a grand uprising in the false belief that the approaching tyrannid swarms will embrace their wayward flock as the lost servants to their benevolent god. In truth, however, the unending swarms of the hive mind will not choose to uplift the cult, and instead, they will simply devour them, as they care not for their personal beliefs, but only for their succulent stores of biomass. Though it seems almost inevitable for every cultist to be consumed, over the long years, we have discovered many gene-stealer cults which have spread out far and wide, with the largest holding several dozen star systems within the gnarled palms of their oppressive patriarch. We have previously looked over three of the largest cults, namely those of the Four-Armed Emperor, the Bladed Cog, and of the Twisted Helix. But today, my dearest friends, we shall investigate three more, named as the Hive Cult, the Rusted Claw, and of the Pauper Princes. It is impossible to predict as to how large these vile cults may grow, nor of whether or not the Imperium will ever discover their foul presence. But for now, I have spoken enough, and I do believe that it is time for us to delve into the Undercity, to learn of these misguided servants to the Great Devourer. The first cult to cover today could perhaps be considered as the most zealous which we have thus far encountered, and they would be known as the Pauper Princes. Due to the inherently secretive nature of the gene-stealer cults, it is challenging to estimate as to how many planets they have actually come to infest. But from our records, it seems that they have spread out through Segmentum Obscurus to form a pernicious presence in some of the Imperium's most strategically important of worlds. Our story begins upon the forlorn slum world, named as Chancer's Vale. This desolate realm had been all but abandoned by the High Lords of the Imperium, who looked upon its harsh, ochre-tinged wastes with such disdain that they only saw fit to provide the bare minimum in the way of support, whilst still ordaining for the constant taxation of the imperial tithe. The world was almost entirely bereft of natural resources, and so there was never a grand effort to erect any vast hive cities. Instead, the impoverished populace, being left to fend for themselves, were forced to construct their own shanty towns, dotted throughout the empty landscape, like graves simply waiting to be filled. The majority of their squalid hovels were found on the empty shores of the barren seas. Here, the only reliable form of work could be found from mining meager quantities of salt and other minerals from the dark oceans. These waters had largely dried up from the aggressive extraction programs of the Imperials, and so the surrounding land was left as a salted, arid waste, so harsh that not a single crop could be grown from its soils. Thanks to this aquatic depletion, the salinity of the remaining dregs of the oceans were so high that almost no sea life could survive, meaning that fishing was all but impossible, and so the residents of Chancer's Vale were entirely reliant upon the limited rations sent from nearby worlds. To walk amidst these shanty slums, we would see humanity at its lowest. Hopeless workers would painfully stumble upon parched earth with sharp stones biting through their long since ruined boots. For those who live by the shore, their skin will be desiccated and scarred by the great mounds of ocean salts, whilst their hands will have developed great gnarls and calluses from working within the extraction plants. Because of all this, there was a single dream held by those who lived upon Chancer's Vale, and it was simply to leave the world by any means necessary. But none could afford passage, and the only crafts which would descend would be of the Imperials, who would only make the voyage to collect their tithe before quickly departing back into the void. Over time, however, this dream grew to include a prophetic figure known as the Star Savior. None knew of when exactly this mythos first took form, but rather curiously, it seemed to spontaneously appear within the minds of the citizenship overnight, accompanied by promises that this being would provide them with the means to leave this forlorn world once and for all. Unbeknownst to the humans of Chancer's Vale, this idea came from a secretive gene-stealer patriarch who had infiltrated their planet, living within a deep salt cave far below their meager township. The first to be stolen away by this alien was of the future Margus, named as Maravich Tendark. As he emerged, newly connected to the psychic song of the Gene Stealer, he realized that this tale of the Star Savior would indeed unite the impoverished populace behind a single movement, which, if successful, could overthrow the oppressive yoke of the careless Imperium. Thus, he moved from slum to slum, delivering rapturous sermons to the desperate workers, promising them that if they truly pledged themselves to the unseen force of the Star Savior, that this entity would one day reveal itself to bring them their long-sought salvation. From this, the cult of the Pauper Princes took form, with more and more of the forlorn humans joining in with the growing movement, in the hopes that it could truly lead to their journey off-world. The most dedicated of followers would soon learn of the presence of the patriarch, but rather curiously, this was not due to the psychic song of the Gene Stealer. In truth, they needed no coercion to join, as in their minds, their long-held dream of fleeing the planet was finally within their grasps, and all they would have to do would be to willingly embrace with the gifts of the alien. As more time passed, the cult had grown to the point where the citizens were openly discussing its teachings whilst out in the streets, Though this was helpful in swelling their numbers, it unfortunately resulted in a rattling sniper discovering the presence of the cult. Taking up his rifle, he descended into the deep salt mines and fired a single round at the heart of the alien star savior. The presiding magus, Maravich Tendark, who had grown this cult from obscurity, dived at the last moment, taking the bullet himself to save the life of his patriarch. With a great scream, the surrounding cultists were spurred to action, crawling up the walls to the rattling's nest, only to tear him limb from limb until all that was left was of a grisly smear upon the cold cave walls. In the wake of his death, Magus Maravich Tendark was declared as a saint, and the assassin was named as an imperial agent who, in the words of the cult, had descended to torment the already arduous lives of those upon this world. As his funeral procession moved through the streets of the many slums, the remaining undecided humans flocked forth, now pledging themselves to the cult, as they could no longer maintain the lie that the Imperium would ever uplift their tragic society. Rather interestingly, Tendark was not laid to rest as this funeral came to its end. Instead, his lifeless corpse was mummified and strung up upon a flag which now exists as the most precious relic of the Pauper Princes. Supposedly, if you were to look closely at the preserved skull of this martyr, you would still see the bullet hole from the rattling sniper, which, if not intercepted, could have led to the ultimate destruction of the cult. Legends say that on the dawn of a great battle, that the most zealous of Tendark's disciples will lead the cultists into a ceremony, where each person must insert two fingers or two talons into the vacant eye sockets of this cadaver. Whilst undeniably morbid, the cultists believe that this will grant them with a portion of the fallen Magus' predestined vision, but beyond this, it is a solemn reminder that if they are called to do so, that they themselves must die to protect the cult. At this point, we can safely say that the entirety of Chancer's Vale had fallen to the sway of the Pauper Princes, and the cultists were now more than willing to do anything necessary to serve their patriarch. It is rather fascinating that because many within this cult were already devoted to the idea of the Star Savior before joining, that since they have been ensnared by the psychic song of the Gene Stealer, that their devotion has been elevated to the realm of zealotry. The Pauper Princes, exemplifying the martyrdom of the fallen Magus Tendark, will eagerly give up their lives if they believe it will somehow further the growth of the cult. There have been reports of hundreds of their members sacrificing themselves at once just to ensure that the cult remains hidden from the prying eyes of the Imperium, or to bring them victory within a dire battle. Some believe that this behavior mirrors that of the lesser bioforms of a tyrannid hive fleet, and so we could speculate that the brood mind of the ruling patriarch has infested and manipulated the minds of the Pauper Princes more so than of any other cult within the galaxy. Their collective behaviors are most commonly observed within the many conflicts which the Pauper Princes have become embroiled in. Not only will the cultists move with an uncanny sense of unison, but if their presiding leaders are ever faced with danger, then the princes will flock to surround them, forming a living shield of zealous martyrs, each being ready to give their lives to prolong the cult. There is a rather sinister extension of this idea, and it would be that the cultists will commonly cry out that to be amongst the faithful flock and to be one of the Pauper Princes is to live forever. From this and from their behaviors, we can begin to understand how those within the cult will see the existence of their collective as being of paramount importance, and that their own lives are simple things to be expended and discarded if it means that the pauper princes can continue to thrive. Upon the field, a force of the princes will primarily consist of a great congregation of lowly hybrids, chanting out in unison as they surround the more prominent cult leaders as a sentient sacrificial barricade. There will be dozens of icon wards and clamvuses whose vox halers will echo out with the saintly words of the fallen Magus Maravich, spurring the masses towards greater feats of glory. As was prophesied by the cultists, the Star Savior did indeed lead the faithful humans off-world, and yet many have chosen to remain upon Chance's Vale, as they believe that they must keep up the facade of loyalty to the Imperium, even if it means that they will die in the desolate slums. But thus far, they have come to infest dozens of worlds, with one of the more notable of cases being of their presence upon the planet of Vigilus, where they brought havoc to the Imperials by seizing control of several important districts within the Hive cities. But for those who remained upon Chance's Vale, their skin has grown ever more desiccated and gnarled from the harsh environment. The scars, however, simply represent their unending loyalty to the cult. If one was to walk amidst their kin, bearing the marks of the Vale, then they would be treated with the utmost respect, as they have truly come to exemplify their teachings of sacrifice after committing themselves to a life within the salty wastes of their ancient home. As a final and utterly horrifying point, some of the pauper princes who escaped from their world were destined to travel far through the void, and as it so stands today, they have established a malign cell upon Holy Terror itself. This has plunged many shrouded regions of the cradle of humanity into a shadowy battleground. And as the unthinkable war continues, we can only wonder as to what will happen if the pauper princes are successful in seizing the birthplace of all mankind for the glory of the cult. The next malevolent group to discuss are named simply as the Hive Cult. More so than any other, the cultists here will focus almost entirely on infiltrating and usurping control over the military elements to be found upon a world. They will almost entirely ignore the useless working or civilian populace, as instead they have found far more success in supplanting their cultists at the head of violent hive gangs and within the ranks of the Imperial Guard. From what we understand, the Hive Cult acts in this way because they believe themselves to hold a divine duty towards making the fated day of ascension as violent and bloody as possible. The tale of the Hive Cult begins upon the hive world of New Gidlam. At one point in this planet's history, its surface was relatively habitable. However, as the Imperium descended and began with the process of harvesting all that was valuable, the outer landscapes have now been blanketed in the thick shroud of pollution. But our story does not take place in the wasteland, and instead we must look to the 13 titanic hive cities jutting out from the surface to scrape against the endless void above. As with most hive worlds, the humans here will export many an industrial product, including the treasured silks sourced from the world's vast roachworm population. Yet their most important resource, which the Imperium depends on more so than any other, would be of the humans themselves. The men and women of the towering cities and surrounding hive sprawl are routinely conscripted to join in with the stalwart ranks of the Imperial Guard. And their many regiments have been deployed to hundreds of distant battlefields all throughout the galaxy. So common was it for the citizens to be drafted that most began to train long before the call to action ever came, which many of them saw as being something of an inevitability. Because of this, an impressive swathe of the populace, even though not a part of the military forces of the Imperium, were more than prepared to fight if it was indeed required of them. Beyond their training, the militant citizens would routinely purchase small-caliber weapons for themselves, storing them away within their personal dwellings, primarily so that they could practice and become more familiar with their chosen tool. Naturally, however, not all upon New Gidlam were amicable to the idea of waiting to join in with the armies of mankind. It would be impossible to count how many hive gangs have appeared within the lower levels of the Undercity, but many of their members were previously citizens who were called to join in the Imperial Guard, yet were too cowardly to stand by their brothers and sisters in a distant war, and so they found refuge far beneath their homes, in the form of a gang who would shield them from the eyes of the law. With that being said, due to the levels of violence found within these gangs and the routine use of firearms in their criminal acts, their members are actually rather prime candidates to be drafted into the Guard. As such, if one wishes to leave their criminal life behind them, then they may find salvation by entering a recruitment office and signing up to the first vessel to take them off world. There are many laws to be followed within a hive city. But when we move down below the surface into the forgotten reaches of the Undercity, it can feel as though almost anything is available, should you have the thrones to pay for it. The black market will truly thrive within these regions, with smugglers, arms dealers, and heisters readily offering up their stock to any who would peruse their wares. One of these merchants was a man who went by the self-appointed title as the Xenozar, who was rather well known for his extensive array of exotic aliens, often sold off to be used as living weapons by those with an evil intent. But as fate would have it, he had somehow managed to smuggle in an entire brood of pure strain gene stealers, which were sold off to a pathetically inexperienced gang who believed that these beasts could give them an edge in their petty turf war. As most of you would expect, the gang members were ill-prepared to withstand the psychic presence of their new pets, and so it did not take long for them to fall under the sway of the presiding patriarch, who they named as the First Father. After inoculating the foolish gang with the Gene Stealer's kiss, the insidious alien quickly took note of their innately violent tendencies. Capitalizing on this, the gang was sent out on a warpath, but now that they had been imbued with Tyranid DNA, they were able to tear through their rivals, ripping them apart with their newly taloned hands. This progressed over the following months, with the gang sparing only the strongest of adversaries, as they would prove to be valuable additions to their cause. Whilst they were unaware of the situation, in truth, we can say that at this point, that the hive cult had taken form. But in any case, a magus had emerged within the burgeoning cult, named as Vokor Mai, and from his connections, he had been successful in swaying the noble dynasties who held the mantle of leadership over their hive. Some were able to resist or could simply see through his gregarious facade, only to find a figure who was clearly reluctant to share in his darkest intentions. At first, the magus fell upon them, silently ensuring that they would never again be able to speak out against his insidious kin. In time, however, some of the more bloodthirsty of cultists were recruited to take on this assassin's role, as they were more than willing to prove their loyalty to both the magus and to the cause of the hive cult. Seeing an opportunity here, Vokor Mai fabricated a dark tale to account for the sudden deaths within the aristocracy. He claimed that a mysterious entity named as the White Creeper had appeared within the hive, with a taste only for the blood of those of a gentle birth. This led to some of the nobles retreating into personal bunkers. However, out of fear, many others flocked to Vokor Mai, as he claimed that through his teachings could he save them from the clutches of this unseen horror. It did not take long until the first hive city was utterly consumed by the cult, as the violent insurrection was swift and bloody. The hybridized cultists had long since infiltrated the defense forces of the hive, and under the darkness of the night, they emerged to slay any who could possibly stand against the wishes of their patriarch, whilst simultaneously inducting those who were prepared to surrender. From here, they moved from hive to hive, bringing the rest of the world into the fold of the cult. At first, they were relatively subtle, mirroring the methods that had previously led them to victory, but eventually they grew far more bold in their violent approach. Their plans evolved to where they would only seek to induct the Imperial Guardsmen and hive gangers of a city, and so once they launched their assault, the defenders would reveal their true allegiances and turn their weapons upon the citizens who foolishly thought of them as their saviors. Since New Gidlam had been a military hub for the Imperial Guard, it meant that the cult was able to produce many gifted Nexos strategists who now oversee the complex battle plans of the Hive cult. As such, it is not unheard of for the hybrids to outmaneuver and overcome enemy forces which vastly outnumber them, slowly picking them away with precise strikes, supported by an impressive array of armored tanks and nimble aircraft. The warriors of this cult will march into battle as an incredibly well-disciplined force, oftentimes outperforming the professionalism of the Imperial Guard, who they once seemed so destined to join. The actual fortresses and bastions of their foes will similarly become a battleground of a far more insidious nature. Carrying the myth of the White Creeper, dozens of Sanctus assassins will crawl through the shadows, aiming to locate the enemy commanders and critical personnel, only to silently dispatch them before slinking back into the dark. As it stands today, 12 of the Hive cities upon New Gidlam have fallen to the Hive cult, and only the city of Tharanex has been able to endure their assault. Though the defenders have learned as to how to combat the cultists, the undercity of Tharanex is locked in a state of perpetual war, with a countless number of hybrids constantly emerging, ever keen to claim the city as the final jewel of their world. Over the course of their campaign, they have taken up the old banner of the New Gidlam 223rd Regiment and perverted it to more suit the aesthetic of the cult. Aside from the huge Tyranid symbology now on display, the cultists have hung up the skulls of the senior ministorum priests and of the personal Lord Haler of the now deceased Commissar Lord. The most curious trophy, however, would be of the exotic creature named as a cyber chimera, which has since been impaled on the protruding spike of their banner pole. This used to be the mascot to the 223rd Regiment, but now it is simply another symbol of the cultists' ascension as the true masters of this world's old military. When they target a new world to claim, they will send out cultists disguised in the equipment of the Imperial Guard and of the local hive gangs to infiltrate the respective ranks of their prey. The members will then work to sway the most able-bodied of warriors to the Gene Stealer's cause, until the time finally comes for an uprising, which will almost certainly be performed as a most bloody affair. The worlds which have thus far fallen to the Hive cult are most often rather military-oriented, and so the cultists have amassed a terrifying army, consisting of tank battalions, support vehicles, and even of an entire fleet of ex-imperial warships. The world of New Gidlam, being located within the confines of Segmentum Solar, is unnervingly close to Holy Terror, as a rather alarming fact, the agents of the Ordo Xenos are receiving ever more reports of the Hive cult appearing upon worlds close to the heart of the Imperium. Almost as if they are setting out on a warpath, destined to reach Terra in but a short few years. The final devotees for us to discuss today will be of the cult of the Rusted Claw. When most of us think of the gene stealer cults, we will imagine a squalid group of mutants hunched within the darkest corner of a forgotten hive district as they formulate their plans on how to stage their grand and bloody uprising. But for the scions of the Rusted Claw, this description doesn't quite fit. Instead, they will roam the open landscapes of the great outdoors, living off of the fruits of the land and sleeping beneath the tranquil stars, glittering above in the beautiful sky of night. But make no mistake, for they are not on a simple camping expedition, as instead they will be hunting for their prey. The cultists are infamous for launching guerrilla wars, ambushing the defensive forces of a world before retreating out into the hills, where they will simply lie in wait until it is finally time to strike again. For the defenders, it can feel like this process never ends, as when they least expect it, they will find themselves staring into the tainted eyes of a devoted hybrid. In any case, the tale of the Rusted Claw begins upon the world of New Seam, found outside of the borders of Segmentum Ultima. This fringe planet was likely first colonized by pioneers who sought to trek across the boundless abyss and to build a home farther away than any human had ever thought possible. But that expedition was completed eons ago. Yet as we move into the 41st millennium, that frontier spirit never seemed to leave the descendants who still call this world as their home. The reason I say this is that the vast majority of this world appeared to have been left in its natural state, with expansive mountain ranges cresting the horizon, jutting out from the boundless steppe below. One could travel for days within these plains, encountering huge avian creatures, diving down to prey upon the small mammals which scamper about through the grasses. But eventually, on our trek, we would find the harsh intrusions of mankind. The Imperial Lords, who saw this planet as only a name upon a list, decreed that it was to become a mining world, and that nature should give way to an industrial sprawl dedicated towards harvesting the valuable resources contained within the deep crust. Though they never saw fit to tear down the mountains, only to replace them with the eyesore of a hive city, the landscapes have since been pocked and marred with strip mines, eating through the ground itself to excavate hundreds of tons of precious metals with each passing day. Very quickly, an incredibly segregated society took form upon the world. The vast majority of the citizenship of New Seam were of the working class, who would live, toil, and die within the subterranean mines, often without ever seeing the light of the sun above them. The ruling minority, however, oversaw their labors from the comfort of their lavish townships upon the surface, where the only hardships they truly faced were from choosing which meal to feast upon come the evening. The so-called upworlders received all of the imperial aid and, more importantly, the profits taken from selling on the rare resources back to the wider galaxy. The miners, however, who were forced to subsist on only basic ration packs, were to continue in their thankless labors without ever seeing a single throne for their efforts. Beyond this, they were forbidden from keeping any of the valuable materials which they had mined up themselves. But this wouldn't stop a small sect of the mining community from smuggling away a portion of their labors to produce a hidden stockpile of their own. Some within the mines, however, disapproved of such collections as they saw the product of their toil as being unnatural, and they believed that material possessions would always lead to the corruption which had produced this world's oppressive society. This segregation continued for years until, on one fateful day, a mining team made a most fascinating discovery. At the end of a deep vein, they found the condensed ruins of a crashed void ship. This had once been the prized vessel of a rogue trader, which mysteriously fell from orbit, only to bore a deep hole into the Earth itself. Rather than informing the upworlders of their curious find, they chose to excavate the craft and to explore the ship's interior, thinking that perhaps they would find some valuables which they could keep for themselves. But as the teams moved through the claustrophobic walkways and rooms, they were met not by treasures, but by broken bones. It seemed as though the old crew had died from their impact, and yet it didn't quite make sense as to why their skeletons had been smashed open to be strewn across the cold steel floors. Venturing down, they found the sealed doors to the cargo bay, and once they pried them open, they were met with a sight most horrifying. It was an alien that had been hibernating since the crash, and yet from all the commotion of their scavenging, it had been roused from slumber. This was a gene stealer, and as it sprung back into life, it immediately exercised its psychic might to enthrall the workers, forcing them to adhere to its desires and to produce the foundations of a new cult. This would go on to be known as the Cult of the Rusted Claw, and it was destined to spread through the deep mines like a wildfire. The oppressed populace were more than willing to hear of the tales told by the excavators, who promised the forlorn workers that if they were to take a pilgrimage down into the ruins of the old ship, that they would find the means to liberate their world from the noble upworlders. Thus, in time, the entirety of the mining complex was whipped up into a state of zealous fervor, eagerly chanting that their time for freedom was now, and that they would bring ruination to those who had oppressed them for so long. Those upon the surface had no idea as to what was occurring beneath their feet, but upon one fateful day, the earth itself split open, and the cultists emerged to seize their world. The upworlders were slain where they stood, and their homes burned to the ground, as the cultists had resoundingly favored the idea that material possessions were innately corrupting. Many of them similarly believed that they would have never been subjected to such a dehumanizing life if only their species could abandon their desire to build wealth. And so, the first sparks of liberating further worlds from their industrial oppression quickly took form. As the cultists walked upon the surface for the first time in their lives, they were met not with the idyllic landscape of their ancestors, but with the sight of pollution. The grounds which surrounded the mines had been reduced to an ashen slag, as all of the industrial waste from their operation had simply been dumped into the steppe, producing a nauseating, acidic bog. This vista, whilst rather disgusting, did imbue them with an idea. They saw that the environment had suffered after generations of industrial toil, but that they themselves were able to reduce an entire society to rubble in but a short yet violent night. Thus, perhaps the cultists themselves were the most corroding influence to be found. And if they were to set out into the stars, then maybe they would be the agents who could put an end to the tyranny of the Imperium simply by bringing ruin to wherever they walked. From their own torment in the mines, they had been broken down and reborn into the magnificent hybrids of the cult, and thus, if they could plunge the galaxy into war, then perhaps from the ashes would life emerge once more, free from the sins of those who came before them. But until that day is finally reached, they see themselves as the agents of entropy, who exist only to reduce the industrial effigies of humanity into a wasteland of smoldering iron. Though they have indeed rejected the concept of personal ownership, the cult of the rusted claw holds one relic to be preserved, and that would be of their marvelous banner. It has been fashioned from the ceremonial cloak of an upworlder ore master, named as Rubio, who held the vast gold mines of Newseam under his bloated thumb. Each time a noble has interfered with their plans, the cultists will slay them and retrieve a small treasure from their corpse, which will then be attached to the banner to show that none may stand against them and survive. Atop the banner pole is the head of a hybrid, who was ceremoniously named as Golden Talon. The story goes that this figure melted down the gold stores of the ore master Rubio and dipped his claw into the molten pool, only to drive it through the blackened heart of this careless man. Rather curiously, the name of this cult, being of the rusted claw, is not merely symbolic. Over the years, we have heard reports that a select few of their members have developed an ability to rust the metals which they come into close contact with. There was once even a video, captured by an agent of the Ordo Xenos, showing a Magus approaching an Imperial tank. And just from laying his hands upon its surface, did the vehicle collapse into a corroded pile of scrap. Though difficult to believe that such an ability could exist, we do have a theory which may explain the phenomena. The thought follows that the senior members of the cult may have been gifted with a symbiotic organism from the gene-stealer patriarch, which would have originally been sourced from a tyrannid bioship. This curious little creature, if metallophagic, would be able to feed and rapidly proliferate when in the presence of metals, being able to spread and grow in a way which would resemble a bacterial colony. This is only an imperial theory, however, and to the cultists, they see it as a divine gift from the gene stealer, who in their mind has similarly embraced their ideals of destruction. Given their disdain for personal belongings, the cult will refuse to live within any form of man-made structure, as it is antithetical to their own beliefs. Thus, they will reside out in the natural environments of a world, preferring to move through the wilds in small groups of nomads. When they descend upon a new world, with the hopes of liberating the populace in the flames of war, they will first roam the uninhabited frontier, taking note of where they could stage an ambush and of how quickly they could devastate the planet's industries. From this, it is understandable that they will produce a large quantity of kelomorphs during this stage. These hybridized desperados will lead daring strikes against the established societies of their world, often carving out a name for themselves as heroic folk legends, whose own tales will draw more and more of the populace forth to join in the nomadic cult. We do not know of how far this cult will spread, but I will end this chapter with a dark quote spoken by Acclamavus of the rusted claw.
All is ground to rot and rust within the crushing jaws of the metallophagic worm. We are but the tattered flesh caught between its fangs. In consumption shall we know. Blessed apotheosis.
There are dozens of smaller cults dotted across the galaxy, each of which will have their own system of beliefs and ideologies, which have been tainted and corrupted by the worming influences of their patriarch. The cultists will be blind to the truth, that they have fallen to the song of the gene stealer, and that even if they are successful in their plans, that they will meet their fates within the belly of the beasts who they so falsely prayed to. Though today I have spoken of three more of the largest gene-stealer cults, you must understand that those which I have shown are only the ones which we have thus far discovered. We have no idea as to how many cults truly exist within the galaxy, nor of how many will appear in the distant future, but it is surely a plague which will remain with us for the rest of our lives. I do not believe that we will ever be free from their presence, and the task of exterminating them from our worlds will likely remain as a fool's errand until the end of time. We must remember that all it will take is a single gene stealer to be roused from hibernation, and if this alien can find a sentient life form to manipulate, then a cult will form. They will grow and stage an uprising before being consumed by a hive fleet. And as more gene stealers are seeded through the galaxy, it seems that this terrible cycle is simply one which will never end. With this, my dearest friends, we have come to our end. Thank you all for listening to this tale of the gene stealer cults in its entirety, and know that I shall soon return with another foray into the grim darkness of the 41st millennium. For now, however, I must once again close this chapter. Thank you again for listening, but I must now wish you all with a warm goodbye.